we're doing something a little bit different for this episode. This is our second to last episode. And what we're going to do is tell each other about a poet that we like. It's a podcast about poetry. We haven't really talked about any specific poets yet. So before we finish the series, we want to do that. So you go first, Jonathan. Tell me about a poet that you admire.
I took this question to be a poet I admire, like not just their writing, but like as a person, because I feel like a lot of what we're trying to do is think about how to be a person who writes poems. I decided to go with Lucille Clifton, in part because she's somebody I'm often thinking about, but also because she seemed germane to a lot of the things that we've talked about. And I think she's unusual among like poets of real consequence, in that I think she had a lot of the same motivations and appetites as like most of us do. But I also think that she had a kind of calling, maybe, that's a little bit unusual among people who end up writing really well, in that I think she saw herself as having almost a duty to care for people as a writer, and in her poems to give people comfort and to give them affirmation. And I think she's interested in creating a kind of welcome, including a welcome specifically for people who may not feel welcome a lot of times in poetry. I was listening to an interview with her today where she talked about deliberately choosing words so that her mother, who was actually also a writer, also wrote poems until Clifton's father basically made her burn them all, but so that her mother and her aunts could read them and understand them. And so there's this interesting kind of cross current, and sometimes it makes the poems less meaningful for me, less interesting to me. But sometimes what that does is it creates for me this really extraordinary tension, in that she's also somebody who's committed to naming things with precision and with getting the blade as sharp as she can make it, and with recording things that seem beyond the reach of hope or comfort or affirmation. And so I think there's a really unique vitality in some of those poems that, I don't know, speaks to me of someone, I don't know, who managed to like bring a kind of goodness or obligation or a sense of responsibility for other people's loneliness that just isn't very familiar in poems that seem accomplished and surprising and interesting to me.
When was she writing? Like what time period? I do know the name Lucille Clifton, and that there's a little passage of hers that I've tried to use in a poem of mine, but I don't actually have her biographical details down at all.
Yeah, I think her first book comes out in the 60s. I can look real fast and see.
Okay.
Pretty sure her first book comes out in the 60s. I think she dies in the early 2000s. Yeah, I think she's born in the 30s, starts publishing in the 60s, and dies in the 2000s at some point. You know, not somebody who had an easy life. She went to college on a scholarship and left the college she initially went to because she just felt like she couldn't fit in because of the poverty she'd grown up in. Her father sexually abused her. You know, later on, she had, I think, 6 kids in 7 years. A couple of them died before she did. She had a couple of bouts of cancer. She was Black in America. She was a woman in America, all these things. And I think she carried with her a real sense of obligation towards other people who might be in pain. And really, even though she was, by her own self-description, very shy, she did have this real commitment, I think, to creating a sense of welcome. And her poems tend to be really along with all the other things, are really companionable. One of the things that's interesting is like you can just I can just like pick up her collected poems or her selected poems from one of her books and kind of read anywhere. And even if it's like it's not one of her better poems, it still feels like just good to be there. She's really good at getting a person with a voice on the page. And then she's very good at making those things agile and imaginative and sometimes really funny and all these other things. But it is something that makes her really unique. And we've been talking a lot, I think, about loneliness in different forms. And it interests me in that regard to think about someone who I think recognized herself, understood herself to be answerable to the loneliness of others and saw poetry, not the readings, not the parties, but the poems themselves as a way of responding to that. Again, I don't want to, I worry that in like focusing on this, I'm oversimplifying her. There's much more to it than that. But that's part of my admiration is that she really, like, I don't see poems as a way to help people in nearly as direct a way as I think she did. And I feel like most people who might try to do that would result in poems that I would feel would be very unhelpful and lifeless.
I might ask you to read something by her, but before we get to that, do you have a sense of what she was like as a member of the community of poets of her time? Like, was she a mentor to people? Was she like, what role did she play for other poets?
So I don't know so much what role she played for other poets of her generation, except that she was friends with plenty of them. She was very much a mentor to younger poets, particularly younger Black poets. And there you just hear from so many poets for whom she was really kind of like a cardinal figure. Years ago, I actually was on a panel about Lucille Clifton, and one of the other panelists was Reginald Dwayne Betts. And he told a story. He was imprisoned when he was, I think, still a teenager. I'm going to get the details wrong because it's been a really long time, but I think he was in solitary and someone slipped him some Lucille Clifton poems. And I don't think at the time he was really somebody who read a lot of poetry. And he talked about that being like this kind of life-saving experience for him. And then he went on to get to know her and study with her, and she became a mentor for him. But I think she had that quality, even for a lot of poets who didn't have the chance to be mentored directly by her. There was a kind of example that she created that I think opened up a lot of possibilities and a sense of potentially belonging for a lot of folks.
Do you want to read something? Did you have something in mind?
Yeah, I can just grab. I mean, I've got a couple of her books here. So I'll start with a poem of hers that I don't love quite as much, that I'm actually somewhat ambivalent about. But this is like probably her most famous poem. It's a poem that I think has been really successful in creating this great sense of welcome. So that same panel I was on, at the end of the panel, the moderator, who's a friend of mine, had the whole audience stand up and recite this poem together. And it was like you could see it's just it really is profound. And so I don't have it marked, but I think I have it by memory. So it's called "Won't You Celebrate With Me?" Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman. What did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed. And so I love those last two lines. The other ones don't do as much for me, but I do find remarkable just how much they do for other people. And then I'll give a couple examples of some poems that are more dear to me. They're almost all her poems are really, really short. And I will say, like, a couple things that she does really well is that she's great at naming things, which I think is like pretty close to like a core poetic virtue, is being able to name things in ways that feel sort of apt and revealing, sort of Adam's chore. You know, language begins, at least mythically, biblically, in naming. And I think she's really good at that. And then she has this very sharp wit, and her poems tend to be remarkably agile as well. And so I'll read a couple that hopefully are different enough from each other to give a bit of a samples. This is Fel, and this is in reference to her mom. Her mom was Thelma. Fel was my first landscape. Red brown is the clay of her Georgia. Sweet attic of a woman, repository of old songs. There was such music in her. She would sit, shy as a wren, humming alone and lonely amid broken promises, amid the sweet broken bodies of birds. This one's called Cigarettes. My father burned us all. Ash fell from his hand onto our beds, onto our tables and chairs. Ours was the roof the sirens rushed to at night, mistaking the glow of his pain for flame. Nothing is burning here, my father would laugh, ignoring my charred pillow, ignoring his own smoldering hands, or his own smoldering halls, sorry. And then one more I marked. This is just an excerpt. She was fascinated with biblical stories, and she was particularly drawn to Lucifer. She liked various plays on her name, Lucille, light, and Lucifer, also going back to light. And so this is from a poem spoken by Lucifer. He says, "Come coil with me here in creation's bed, among the twigs and ribbons of the past. I have grown old remembering this garden, the hum of the great cats moving into language, the sweet fume of man's rib as it rose up and began to walk."
Wow, there are just so many of those lines that I feel like I'm not going to ever forget. Like, shy as a wren. Shy as a wren. Come on. That's so good. The line that I've been trying to work into this poem that I've never really been able to finish is I think it's something like the world is turning in the body of Jesus and the future is possible. I really, really like "and the future is possible." But yeah, I don't know enough Lucille Clifton to be like lifting a line out of one of her poems and using it in one of my own. But so yeah, I need to get a selected and actually read some. I mean, I guess the obvious other question in terms of admiration is like, does her work have anything to do with yours? Is there any link at all there between what she does and what you try to do?
I always find that question mysterious, not because I don't think there is, but because I don't have a sense of like what's going on in myself. These things are all in there, and then something comes out, and I know it's like composed of all these sounds I've heard in other people's poems and all these ways of thinking, but I don't understand what comes from what at any point. I would say with her, probably less than a lot of other poets who are important to me. One of the things that I'm grateful to for her is that she shows me that there's more to poetry than what I would make of it. And I don't feel any need to like encompass that same terrain, or that I have any of the aptitudes to do it, but I'm really glad it's there. And it's nice to have things there that like you aren't that you don't have to be everything, that the universe can be larger than the things you do, and the universe of things that you cherish can be larger than the things you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so how about you? Who's your person?
My person. Okay. When I was thinking about how to answer this question, my first impulse was to talk about Ern Mali, the Mali poems. Because I don't know, I feel like I want to be entertaining. I feel like the audience for this show is like probably at least half American. And I kind of want to tell you a funny story about some guys who did some weird stuff in the 1940s and fooled a whole nation into believing that a non-existent poet was the best thing since sliced bread. But then I thought about it and I'm like, I don't admire Harold Stewart and James Macaulay for doing that at all. They're total bitches for doing that. Like, they picked on a young editor by the name of Max Harris just because they could. And now Ern Mali is like the sort of this specter across all of Australian poetry. And no, I don't admire that. So I shelved that idea.
Before we move on, what kind of specter is he? Like, is he like a warning that we should be careful about liking things? I mean, I'm guessing that there are kind of lessons that people have learned from that. Like, what are the fears that injected into the bloodstream?
I think the fear is, don't be fooled. Don't take anything too seriously. Don't like anything too much, because what if it's not real? What if you're being hoodwinked? I suppose he's an expression, and I can't help but, like, I hate that I refer to Mali as a he, because the Mali poems are poems written by two people. But the figure of Mali that they made up is an expression of, I think, the Australian unwillingness to take anything in a totally sincere way. Like, when you're reading those Lucille Clifton poems, my whole body is tingling, right? I'm like really responding to them. And then there's this other voice in my head that's like, oh my God, don't, you're embarrassing. You're embarrassing yourself. Don't, like, don't give yourself over to this thing. So yeah, that's the specter of Mali, I suppose. Yeah, what if it's all a joke? And the poet that I'm actually going to talk about is a master of jokes and a master of not taking things too seriously, even though she, I think, in her heart of hearts is a very serious and concerned person. So the poet I want to talk about is Pam Brown. And she was born in 1948. She is still writing. She just put out her most recent book just came out the other week. I probably talked about it on here, going to her launch party and trying to talk to people and having just, you know, the same time I always have, just a completely awkward time. Pam has, I admire Pam not just for the way she writes. I do admire her for that a great deal and have tried to imitate her with no success for many years. But as much as I admire her writing, I admire Pam as a person and for the way that she operates as a poet in the world of Australian poetry. She's been writing for 4 decades. She has published more books than she can count. And when I say that, you know, I know we had a conversation somewhere about how that's not necessarily a great thing. But in Pam's case, it feels like it is truly just an expression of her existence in the world, is that she will always be writing and she will publish the poems. And they're not put out with any expectation that, like, she's very unassuming. She's quite a humble person. And that's really in contrast to a lot of her contemporaries, who will also publish a book every 18 months, but you are expected to go to the party and you expected to read it, and those people expect to win prizes, and they do win prizes. Pam didn't get that kind of attention for many, many decades, but she kept writing and she stayed in the game and she stayed supporting other poets, particularly younger poets, and stayed in relationship with them. And then finally, eventually, with this book that I'm going to read from, which is called Click Here for What We Do, she won this thing called the ALS Gold Medal, the Australian Literature Society Gold Medal, which is a funny thing in a country like ours that we have, but it is like literally you get like a little gold medal in a box. She showed it to me. I'm like, holy shit, it's a medal. You got a medal. You deserve a medal for staying in this for so long. And look, hypothetically, Jonathan, I don't know if you're aware of this, but at the moment we're looking for our very first poet laureate of Australia. Hypothetically, if Pam had been asked to be the poet laureate of Australia, she would have turned it down. Now, I'm not saying that that's what happened, but that's what would have happened. So, yeah, that's Pam as a person. She has been such a favorite of mine for so long, and when I finally did interview her for Poetry Says, I was so underprepared, hideously underprepared. I think I was like that nervous that I'm just gonna fucking wing it. So got there with like 2.5 questions, and she was so kind to me. She was so lovely and welcoming, and so again, like humble and unassuming, and just has she's got no ego. She's got no ego at all. And she's one of the only poets of that generation who, after we had our interview, said, "Okay, well, let's go for a cup of tea." And then we went and like talked as people. And I was like, "Oh, yeah, this could also like she wanted to be a friend to me." In a way that was just very, is not something I experienced much in doing that work. You know, people were very kind and they were very happy to talk to me, but it was very rare for somebody to sort of treat me as another, you know, as something more than just like a promotional outlet for them, I suppose, to be really like harsh about it. And that's how she was, that's how she is with everybody. She's just treats you like a friend. And I think I told you this part of the story off air, but I may as well include it here now. At that launch that we went to, I was, you know, it was Pam's night. She was really like shining. Everyone was like, she's amazing, isn't she? I'm like, yeah, she is amazing. Like, she's fucking amazing. And as I was leaving, I was kind of saying goodbye and I was being quite obsequious. I couldn't really stop myself from being that way. And Pam just sort of stopped me and was like, "Alice, stop thanking me. You're a friend." She just like basically slapped me down in the best possible way and reminded me that, you know, I had a right to be there too. And not everybody's like that.
I have questions, but it might help to hear some of her poems first, because I don't know
No, of
her poems.
course. Yeah.
Would you mind reading?
Yeah. And so, look, I love Pam's work, but I'm also like very aware that, unlike Lucille Clifton, like this is not work that is going to connect with everybody. It's a very particular, sort of laconic, in-jokey, disjointed Australian style. It's very much about tone and references and. You use the word baggy to describe your own work recently. These poems are also quite baggy. So I'm going to read you they're all quite long, part of a poem from Click Here for What We Do called Left Wondering. And I'll just stop partway through. Nothing virtual about it. No tap, no swipe, just years lost pounding cash registers. Ka-ching, nostalgia. It's difficult to have a sense of humour lying down. My mother, the immigrant, always said, "You have to pay a lot for the privilege. It won't get you anywhere, anyway," she said. Wheeling an adult baby in a shopping trolley through Booker Bay car park tiers. Hashtag save Newtown from tattoos. Have-nots houses entirely plastic wrapped for fumigation. Sticky silver fork lying on imported tiles under double glazed windows. Middle class grot. Slurp, slurp. You didn't even see where you were. You looked down at your phone all the way across the steel blue harbour you'd never seen before. Everyone so metropolised and insular. Far and near disappears. The big Leyland Kirby things, good for grey sunsets. It's the day will come. Needs serious music. Leaving the Lost Brisbane Facebook page, no longer know how to change the law for good. Shrug into, slip into detachment. Order chips on the side. Who wants to take pity on today's world? Its hopes of health and happiness. Raw genomics, mashed with moralism. More pets than people. Rescued pugs mule over astroturf territory. Spry ferals scurry along light rail tunnels. Big screens flashing bright on dingy platforms. It's all going to end in something. And there will be speeches. Political staffers promoting fear. Plus more currentness against everything. I'm against barracking for innovation. Ingenuity never disappeared. Is it just me? Yes? Am I wrong? Click here for what we do. So I read a lot of it because I feel like you need the cumulative effect over time. There are a lot of references in there that probably make absolutely no sense to you. But one of the images that I love in there is she talks about you looked down, you didn't even see the still blue harbour. When you catch the Circular Quay train, and you'll do this when you come to Sydney, you catch the Circular Quay train, it comes out of the tunnel. And if you're looking up, if you're not staring at your phone, you get to see Sydney Harbour all at once, the Opera House, the bridge, the water, the ferries. It all just hits you as you come out of this tunnel. But when I catch that train, I watch people just like stare into their phone and I'm like, look at the fucking harbour.
So listening to that at first blush, I find it beguiling.
Oh, good. That's good.
And somewhat inscrutable.
Yeah, definitely inscrutable. And
also, I'm not sure how much I really need, like, how much the poem needs me to like unpack it or to track it.
No, it kind of doesn't reward that in a way, or at least, yeah, you don't
okay.
need it. You don't need to do that. But like, if you get the references, you get another layer. But yeah, I think you're right. It's not necessary.
And like, one thing I'm wondering about initially is to what extent I like experiencing a sort of unified or singular consciousness, and to what extent am I experiencing like a collection of different things that might be seen or overheard that would represent a lot of different experiences and consciousnesses. And it's probably not fair to ask you to answer that, but I want to ask you something that's probably even less fair to ask. You talked about this being someone who is just going to write. Like that's my impression of what you said. Like she is someone who, like, if no one cares, if like the power gets turned off and the water stops running, she's just going to sit down and write. And then the next day she'll sit down and write again. I'm intrigued by what the impulse might be. Because, you know, we talked in a previous episode about kind of what we want out of our own poems. And one of the things I was hung up on was this idea that it needs to be mine in some way. And this feels like something that maybe she doesn't need to be hers in that way. So I'm curious, you know, you've talked to her a little bit, you've spent time with her poems. Do you have a sense of what it is that compels this?
That's the thing. I really don't. I don't, because usually what you encounter when you talk to a poet, particularly in the way that I was, when you talk to them, you get a sense that they have ambition. And the thing about Pam is that she is writing all the time and she publishes a lot, but she doesn't seem to have, it doesn't seem to come from a need for recognition. I think she was really happy when she got that gold medal, but I think she would have just kept writing anyway. Do you know the satin bowerbird? Do you know of the satin bowerbird? Okay, it might be just an Australian bird. Anyway, the satin bowerbird is this beautiful, dark, dark, almost black blue bird, and the male creates a bower. And the way that he does this is he collects only blue things. He just flies around. He gets like milk bottle caps and little bits of plastic, and he makes a big blue bower. And then in front of the bower, he does this like special dance for his ladies. Yeah, I think Pam is a bowerbird poet. I think she's like she collects moments, she collects fragments and thoughts and bits of overheard speech, and she makes a beautiful bower out of it. And that is the thing that I wanted to emulate and imitate. I thought, I can do that. I can do that. And then I started trying to do it, and I realized it's so hard to make that
Serious.
bower. Yeah.
Like I have a friend who has a new book coming out, and it's wonderful. And I've been reading her poems for decades, and I read these poems, and I don't like I don't know, because it's like she removes all the ligaments and like all the bones, and then it stands up. I'm like, well,
Totally.
how do you know what to leave in? Like, are you just constantly shuffling something else in, or do you just have this instinct? It's utterly mysterious to me how you can proceed by association or whatever it is, and like know how to, you know, like how to not have the Jenga just fall apart.
Completely. That proceeding by association is precisely what Pam is doing. And I started to see, as I started to try to do the same thing, that what it required was a very relaxed approach, a very open and relaxed approach, which I just, as a like super anxious and worried person, and I think like Pam is anxious and worried too, but somehow when she's writing poetry, that's not. She becomes something else. The other poet who I guess, like, I don't know if this is a good idea to mention or not, but just for American listeners who kind of maybe want to situate where Pam is in like the scheme of things, one of the people who I think she reads and maybe has a relationship with is Ray Armantrout. And that's like sort of, if you were to read more of Pam's work, you would see that there is like quite some quite stark differences between the two, but I think they both operate with the same strategy a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I don't know Armand Trout's poems super well, but like the poem you were reading feels much more populated than the Ray Armand Trout poems I've read. Like the Armand Trout poems feel so spare.
Well, they're a lot shorter for one thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and they just, I don't want to speak, well, the Armand Trout poems feels oftentimes kind of quirky to me. Like they really are just mapping an individual consciousness. And like, I know you said that Brown isn't ambitious, but this feels more ambitious in the sense that it wants to take in something. So I feel much more in the world listening to that.
Yeah, she's it's a sort of a the person that you would think of, it's that sort of just walking around, I do this, I do that, O'Hara mode, but it's actually she's much closer to Skylar, I think. She's more sort of it was a day like any other. I feel like that could be an organizing sort of principle for Pam's work. But now I don't know. I hate like one of the things she did say when I interviewed her the second time, which didn't end up making it into the interview, was we have to stop comparing ourselves to Americans.
Yeah, that
We got our
sounds
own
like
thing
kind of
going
good
on.
advice.
So yeah.
You know, you talked about the, was it satin bowerbird? I also thought a little bit when once you brought up birds about like a mockingbird who's like
Yeah.
composing this song that's their own but also not their own. I mean, I don't actually know how mockingbirds do what they do, but like it seems like an improvisation of, you know, just these scattered pieces around it. One thing I'm wondering as well is how much, like you talked about how she doesn't, the compulsion seems pretty far removed from recognition or even maybe from readership. And I do wonder how different what she gets from writing it is from what one might get from reading. That like there's a very different pleasure of composing in that way. Or maybe they're very much like two sides of like the screen that the shadow is projected on. Maybe it is the same kind of sense of discovery. I don't know. I'm interested in like this as a kind of humility, like because it sounds like a very humble person. And like, is it a sort of like way to get away from yourself to compose in this way that you can kind of take all the noise of your thoughts and make them stop being noise?
Yeah, I mean, I would resist any sort of suggestion that she is just writing for herself. And the reason I say that is because when you get to see Pam read, one of the things that happens a lot is that people laugh. She's got a lot of jokes in her poems. And yeah, she's very witty. I think that, like, that is why these poems amaze me so much, is because they seem so relaxed. They seem entirely effortless to me, and yet I know that there is a huge amount of work in their composition as well. Like these are not first drafts, or the way I've described it before is it's like the calligraphic mode, which is not a particularly great description that I've come up with, but it's like when you learn to write calligraphy, you have to write the same character over and over again a million times until you can just like do it perfectly in one go. And I think the thing with a poet like Pam is that she writes all the time. She's never not writing. But then it's a question of like, okay, what gets into the book? What gets into the poem? So maybe everything in Click Here for What We Do and all the other books is like a first draft. But there's clearly a very canny editor's mind at work in like taking, well, this is the poem, this is the line I wrote on that day. I'm going to put that one in. All this other stuff that I wrote in these other days needs to go out. That's my guess as to how she does it and what she's doing. But yeah, even having interviewed her twice, I never really managed to pin her down on that.
So we've promised that we wouldn't actually give advice on the show.
Oh,
But
no.
is there anything we should learn about being a person or being a person who writes poems from either of these people? Or is it just that there's a lot of room out there?
Well, I think, yeah, that is true. There's a lot of room out there. But one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, and I think it is probably a theme of this series that we've made, is loneliness. I've been thinking about how, for lack of a better way of putting this, giving to others, supporting others, being the person who, like, puts their hand up and says, I'm going to contribute, is the antidote to that feeling. And I think both of these poets in different ways do that. It almost feels like it's the expected thing that as a poet, you will spend all your time thinking about your work and what you're getting and your legacy and how, your particular little collection of bitterness. That's what you get, and that is a really lonely way to be. And the way out of that is to sort of turn towards the other people around you and say, all right, what can I do?
Yeah, the other thing I'm thinking of is like I think in yeah I stumbled across when we were talking earlier the idea that the Brown poems feel populated, and I think there's a different way in which Clifton also makes the world feel populated. I don't think that's something super new, the idea that poems can make us feel less alone. I mean, that's something we've been talking about over and over again. But I guess I am a little bit struck at how differently they can do that.
Yeah, like you said, there's a lot of room out there.
Yeah, and there's room for a lot of different kinds of readers too. You set up the excerpt you read by saying this is not going to be for everyone. And I had the experience of the room full of people reciting, "Won't you celebrate with me?" It's this like it's a poem that can bring people to tears, but it's also not one of my favorite of her poems. Seeing if I can connect this may be a reach, but I think one challenge of the poetry, the poetry social world, I guess, is that it can feel hard to be a person as like an audience, as a attendee. It can feel hard to be a person with distinct tastes and reactions if we're all there to love the thing that's there. I don't know. I mean, maybe this is another way in which I can make things a little less about myself, that I can go to a reading that isn't for me and still be excited because someone has done something and it's giving someone else pleasure or consolation or whatever. It doesn't have to matter so much.
It sort of feels like what we're getting at is the idea of not putting yourself right at the very center of things. Yourself, your own preferences, your own taste, your own needs, quote unquote, as a reader, as a writer. And it seems like in different ways these two poets have managed to just sort of decenter themselves, to use an internet word, and that's to everybody's benefit. And we both like that.
Yeah. And then sometimes it's to everybody's benefit when somebody puts themselves smack dab at the center of the universe, and that's that can be thrilling as well.
Well, totally. I mean, it's weird. Like, as an Aussie, I feel like I'm allowed to like Whitman. But I feel like you guys are like, oh my God, don't talk to me about Walt
We're not allowed
Whitman.
to
And
like
I'm like, oh,
Whitman.
go on. Go on. He's all right.
We're not allowed to like Whitman.
I don't know. People seem to be a bit weird about it sometimes. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're talking about somebody who puts themselves at the center, that's who comes straight to my mind.
Sure.
Yeah. Look, we're next week we're gonna do our last episode.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, we've almost made a thing.
Will we get there?
I mean, I'm relatively optimistic at this point.
We
Hoping
just
we
got to
both have
last
more than
one more
one week to
week.
live.
One
Yeah.
more week.
Eat lots of veggies and
Yeah. Look both ways.
stay away from anvils and yeah.
Chandeliers.